Blog Talk Radio.
I got a letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it and burned that. Man, the way that I live, don't concern that. Man, we gon' have to settle this another way. A letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it and burned that. Man, the way that I live, don't concern that. Man, we gon' have to settle this another way.
Movement, music, move into it. Put a fist up, prove it to us. This is much more than music to us. This is beauty and strength. And if you know about the music, then you know about life. This is movement, music, move into it. Put a fist up, prove it to us. This is much more than music to us. This is beauty and strength. And if you know about the music, then you know about life.
Word is
any kind of activity that takes place on the floor of the Congress or the Senate, that's the government. Any kind of dilly-dallying, that's the government. Any kind of pussyfooting, that's the government. Any kind of act that's designed to delay, or deprive you and me right now of getting full rights, that's the government that's responsible. And any time you find the government involved in a conspiracy,
turn, I can never go back. Life without parole, upstate, shackled and trapped. Living in the hole, looking at the world through a crack. Fuck that, I'd rather shoot it out and get clapped. I've gone too far, there ain't no coming back for me. Auschwitz gas chamber full of Zyklon B. Just like the Spanish exterminating Tainos, raping the black and Indian women, creating Latinos. Motherfucker, made me out of self-righteous hatred. And now you got yourself a virus, stuck in the matrix. A suicide bomber, strapped and ready to blow. Lethal injection, strapped down, ready to go. Don't you understand, you'll never let me live out in peace. Concrete jungle, guerrilla war out in the streets. Nat Turner with the sickle, pitchfork and machete. The end of the world, motherfucker, are you not ready?
DJ Tony Drake.
This is DJ Tony Drake, a.k.a. Mr. Top Shelf himself. And right now, you're in tune to Your World News, where journalism and activism are not mutually exclusive. Here on yourworldnews.org.
You can't tell me life was meant to be like this. A black man in a world dominated by whiteness. Ever since the Declaration of Independence, we've been easily brainwashed by just one sentence. It goes, all men are created equal. That's why corrupt governments kill innocent people. With chemical warfare, they created crack and AIDS. Got the public thinking these were things that black folks made. And every time there's violence shown in the media, usually it's a black thing. So where are they leading you? To a world full of ignorance, hatred and prejudice. TV and the news for years they affected this foolish notion that blacks are all criminals, violent lowlifes, and then even animals. I'm telling the truth, so some suckers are fearing me, but I must do my part to combat the conspiracy.
Welcome to another edition of Your World News on this January 4th, 2012, first show of the new year. And this is Your World News. I'm your host, Solomon, and we are always dedicated to waking up the zombies and mobilizing and galvanizing the masses to press on. The struggle continues. It's another year, another struggle. So I can't say Happy New Year, but if you have your health and your physically free, then I guess that there is merit to be happy that you can use your able body and hopefully your able mind, because it's one thing to be physically free. Many of us that are out here in the real, in the so-called free world, where our minds are in complete shackles, unaware that we are continuously being oppressed and repressed, and we're caught up in the illusions of many illusions, such as America being a post-racist society, a post-racial society, and all these other things. But if you have a free mind, if you have a body that is unshackled, and you have your health, that is that's cause for celebration, because now you can be on the front lines of the struggle, getting out in the streets and mobilizing and educating your neighbors, your family members, and politically, and in so many other ways. And so Yo World News, we're just trying to play our little part by facilitating open free space for people to call in to voice their opinions and, more importantly, their ideas. We have, have an opportunity to share information from scholars, activists, organizers across the board. And that's really what makes our show so special, is the listeners and the special guests that we have on. And today, being January 4th, we've got a wonderful guest who is on here in the vein of trying to wake folks up and to understand that, that America is far from being this sweet as honey, illusion that many of us think that we're living in. It is a capitalist hellhole that is riddled with many, many threads of racism, institutional racism, which is the most deleterious form of racism. It's not being called nigger, it's not being called spick, it's not being called gook. It's none of those things. It is being denied the opportunity for communities to determine their own destinies, because because you have a rapacious prison industrial complex that preys upon black and brown people like a starved animal, because you have black and brown and people of color in general being denied FHA home loans, because you have an apartheid state that people of color are living in, an apartheid school system, which we'll be discussing today. This is the reality of America. And the sooner that we wake up, the sooner we start to change. The sooner we have the opportunity to change this system collectively, one for all and all for one. But as long as we continue to buy into these capitalist pipe dreams, and I'm so glad that it's the 4th now, and tomorrow will be the 5th. And every day that we move away is a day moving further away, but at the same time moving closer to this capitalist holiday that we just left called Christmas, where people are on this feeding frenzy, running around to try to buy as many gifts as they can to prove to their loved ones that they love them by buying as many gifts as possible. At the same time, 70 or more percent of working Americans are living check to check. People college students are graduating with $25,000 in debt. It makes no sense whatsoever, and it's hard to defend education anymore. And being a hypocrite, I'm speaking as a hypocrite, because I'm someone who went through the rigors of undergrad and grad school, and I'm in debt to my eyeballs with student loan debt. And so, and I did everything the system asked me. But where did it get me? In debt, like so many other folks. Right now, there's about $1 trillion in student debt that is floating out there, and much of it is facing default. And so it makes no sense, unless you are living in a capitalist debtor society, which we are, that people would go to college and then step outside and have $25,000 on average, in many cases it's more, in some cases less, but many cases it's more, and be facing this kind of debt and to have to pay this debt off for the next 20, 30, 40 years of your life. And we know you can't declare bankruptcy and get rid of debt. You just simply can't. So we'll be discussing a range of these things with scholar, activist, author, attorney, Danny Weil. He'll be joining us live from from the Bay Area, California, will be calling in and will be spending a good portion of this show with us for a very, very important show. He's going to be dropping a lot of information, a lot of knowledge that hopefully everyone that's listening will take that knowledge and do something with it, even if it starts with your own family and disseminating that information and using it to protect yourself from these vultures that are out there. And the sooner we see the system for what it is, we can start to maneuver around these pitfalls that are set up for us. So without further ado, as usual, I'm going to start off with a clip from Glenn Ford. At about, I would say, another 5 minutes, we'll be joined by Danny Wild. But this is a clip from Black Agenda Report that just came out today. And it's a forecast and update on the rapacious stop and frisk laws that we see in many major cities like New York and Philadelphia. And this should be a stark reminder that we continue to live in this white supremacist, institutionally racist, settler state, otherwise known as America. And you can spell, in this case, America with 3 K's.
The massive industrial strength stop and frisk policies of big cities like New York and Philadelphia must be viewed as part and parcel of urban gentrification, the systematic removal of blacks from the cities. What began as a straightforward intake valve for the 40-year-old national policy of mass black incarceration has evolved into a regimented, calibrated mechanism for adding value to urban land by making city life untenable for young black and brown men. The constant threat of being snatched up by police for no reason within the individual's control on the basis of his profile and the policeman's whim forces thousands of young men and their parents to make a choice. They can exit to a less hostile police environment or stay and risk that life-changing encounter with the criminal justice system from which they may never recover. There is no way to tabulate the impact that stop and frisk has had on the black exodus from New York City. Such decisions are made in the midst of whirlpools of stress in besieged black neighborhoods. But there is ample anecdotal evidence that the relentless pressures of stop and frisk have substantially contributed to the mass exile of blacks from New York. How could it be otherwise? The new year is less than a week old, but already more than 6,000 people have been subjected to stop and frisk, on top of the more than 700,000 or so last year, and the 3 million since 2004, overwhelmingly black and brown men. The last yearly data showed that 132,000 black males between the ages of 16 and 24 were stopped for no good constitutional reason, which was a shocking number to the Community Service Society, since there were only 120,000 black males of that age living in New York City at the time. Police stops of black males in that age group amounted to more than the total population of the entire local demographic cohort. Official New York is saying to these young men and their families, you can leave by way of prison after some fateful run-in with the cops, or you can find some other place to go, but we are going to make it very risky to live here. Two women came to a meeting of Occupy Harlem last month, in rage and in tears at the prospect of losing their sons to the predatory police stop-and-frisk patrols, where literally anything can happen to your child. One of the mothers was in emotional agony. Her son was threatening to leave New York to live with relatives in Atlanta so that his life would no longer be subject to the arbitrary, racist, or corrupt character of whatever policeman was the next to stop him on Harlem streets. The mother was in torment. She loved her teenage son and wanted to keep him by her side, but if he didn't leave for Atlanta, he might be snatched away some sunny afternoon, like the son of the other mother on the stage, who was led away in handcuffs after his last stop and frisk. Should the whole family leave for Atlanta? Back in the day, we called the police an army of occupation in the ghetto. Today, they are an army under orders to make it as difficult and dangerous as possible for black males and their families to continue to occupy their old neighborhoods. There are other people whose presence would be much better for land and housing values. Stop and frisk provides an incentive for a quick racial and economic transition. Harlem without the Harlemites. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to blackagendareport.com.
And as many of us know, I thought that was an excellent report, as usual, but as many of us know, the stop and frisk, you're looking at, 6,000 already in New York City this year alone. Last year, it was something like, I believe it was something like 600,000 or 700,000 stop and frisk, and the vast majority of them were black and Latino. It was like something like 85% were black and Latino, and 90% of those black and Latinos were found to be doing nothing wrong. This is another component of the evidence that we continue to live in a very, very racist society, fundamentally, institutionally racist society. And yes, it's very much capitalist society, but America, in terms of its name, has always been founded on institutional racism and white supremacy. From the very days that European settlers came over here and stole this land, stole America's land, this land that soon became named America from indigenous people, mass slaughtering them, Pequots, Narragansett, you name it, Esquimalt, indigenous people, throughout the New England area, and then moving westward, and they like to name it these little cute terms, westward expansion, instead of what it really was. It was theft, plunder of land, and mass genocide. So Glenn Ford was right on, and in a moment we're gonna be joined by Danny Weil, who has been doing, as I said before, his work precedes him. I mean, he's been doing some amazing work throughout his lifetime. And I'm talking about, for several decades, he's been doing terrific work. He's an author, has written very important pieces, very important books, and has written countless articles for outlets like Daily Censored, for Truth Out, and even our own Your World News, yourworldnews.org, where you can find some of his work as well. He's been writing on social justice. He has a particular focus in education. I mean, he's been attacking charter schools way before a lot of folks who are activists, rightfully so, took up the mantle and have been fighting this whole charter school scam, which is basically a corporatization of public schools in America, and has been talking about the apartheid state of education. I mean, schools in 2012 are just as segregated as they were in the 60s, And so, keep your crap. If this is the first time that, you're hearing this and you still insist on believing that we live in some post-racist society because we have a phenotypically brown-skinned man in the White House who basically is the same old institution with a brown face on it, then you need to go slap yourself and wake up, all right, because Obama and the cronies that he's surrounded himself with are very much a part of the problem, and he and his administration have been heading the charge with this corporatization, this charter school movement, and carrying on the tainted legacy of Bush and No Child Left Behind. This one's called Race to the Top. So Danny Weil has been doing amazing things. Started, schools, people of indigenous ancestry, and I believe it was in either New Mexico or Arizona. I mean, he's been to Central America and been on the right side of justice, when the U.S. was on the wrong side, of justice, in terms of funding the Contras and the death squad that were just going through, Central American town and village and country, one by one. So I'm glad to welcome on there. But before I welcome Danny, I want to play this, Danny, before I welcome you on. I want to play this. This was something that was on Russia Today, and I want folks who are maybe, you know, quasi new to the whole, maybe, you know, you've been impacted by student loans and just don't know how deleterious this issue is. Maybe you do know it to the extent of it, what it is, but either way, I think this was a great report that was done by RT that kind of put things in a very vivid context. So I'm going to play this, and immediately when it's over, I'm going to welcome Danny on and start by getting his thoughts.
Now, America's biggest debt burden is now on the shoulders of people who have yet to even start a career. The money owed on student loans now outstrips the nation's credit card debt as the number one financial problem. And the surging unemployment rate of nearly 10% is only likely to worsen the situation. RT's Anastasia Cherkina has been to meet some of those badly hit by the crisis.
A ticking time bomb of American debt. This time, all this is owed by college students, $3,000 adding on every second.
If I keep going at the rate that I went the first year, by the time I'm finished, I will have about $120,000 worth of debt, just from school loans.
The most traditional financial baggage dragging behind for Americans has been credit card debt. For the first time, debt belonging to college students has taken over that number one spot.
Students graduating in 2008, 2009, and 2010 are facing the worst job markets in a generation at least. And so you have people who have more debt than we've ever seen before and are having a harder time finding any job, let alone a job that pays them enough to somehow pay off all this debt.
29-year-old Shayna is haunted by major money problems. What she earns now is barely enough to survive on a day-to-day basis, let alone pay back for her education.
The money that comes from the internship is, like I said, very little and doesn't pay for much. It'll pay for maybe a dinner or two.
The connection between lack of a good enough, if any, job and growing debt has never been as tight for graduates. According to some reports at certain American universities, students have been borrowing 70% more money in the last year.
The universities are actually cutting deals with the student loan companies and making money on the side. There's been a lawsuit in New York, $1 million fine against Columbia University for steering people to expensive loans. The danger here is that instead of capitalism, we end up with serfdom because these students are kind of indebted for life.
Dennis House lives in a basement in Queens with two roommates.
Your loan that you're paying back shouldn't cost as much as it costs you to live in a home. What they're doing is completely lowering the standard of living for an entire generation of people who couldn't help it in any way.
Just months after graduation, Dennis's relationship with his loan company is already abusive.
They're terrible. They're the biggest loan sharks, you know, in the world right now. If you're late on a payment, they'll harass you.
This harassing can never go away. College debt owners cannot file for bankruptcy.
Your housing debt, your car debt, your credit card debt, if you go bankrupt, it gets wiped away. You literally cannot get out of your student debt. If you decide you can't pay it, too bad. Student loan debt's special, and it's especially sticky and hard to get rid of.
When your credit score falls, getting a job becomes even harder. Many companies check these numbers. Outside a major loan corporation, journalist Joe Wiesenthal says youth is often pressured into taking on commitments it can't afford without even realizing it.
There's an incredible amount of propaganda regarding student loans and education in general, just in terms of people saying, you know, I mean, how many times have you heard the phrase, education is the best investment you can make?
But unless a drastic turnaround in the system takes place, that statement may soon become obsolete.
Ever since an economic crisis began in the U.S., the debate of how it started and how to define what's happening now has been nonstop. In this turmoil, a generation that is supposed to be the driving force of the country got stuck, jobless and indebted. So what happens next if the future of those who have to run the future is this bleak? Anastasia Cherkina, RT, New York.
Danny, can you hear us?
Danny, yes, can you hear me? Are you there? Are you there?
Yes, I can hear you.
Yes, I heard the RTPs.
Okay.
Are we on the
air?
Sorry.
Yeah, we're on the air. I'm sorry. That was actually on my end, but I just wanted to reiterate what I just said, that I think that most people didn't hear me because of technical issues on my end. But I just want to reiterate that, as I was saying, that Danny Weil is an activist first. He has his JD, meaning he's an attorney. He has his PhD. And I think Danny would be the first person to say that the most profound and important education he's received is the information that he's acquired outside the classroom on his own and actually through experience, through his activist work. And you know, this conversation we're using education as a point of departure. We're going to be talking about a range of things regarding education, because so many listeners have emailed me in the past few weeks asking for this show and asking for Danny Weil to be brought back on. But without a doubt, we can't talk about education in America without talking about capitalism, as the RT piece just alluded to. But we also are not going to be able to talk about education without talking about institutional racism, which Danny Weil has covered with his in places like Detroit, Frederick Douglass High School, and a range of schools in California that he's done a lot of work around. So, Danny, it's my pleasure once again to have you back on Your World News. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much for having me again, Solomon, and welcome to the theater of cruelty. Under neoliberal economic policies, as we enter into the late stage capitalism, we've taken a generation of young people, and we've betrayed them as elders, and relegated them to the margins of society in ways that have turned them into an excess population, or what can be called a disposable population. Children are used to be thought of as the future of this country, and now they're thought of as either a problem in this country or as consumers. So children are not, it's not so much that children are at risk, it's that the new ideology of culture and cruelty has defined children as the risk.
That's right. I couldn't agree more. You heard the piece on RT, and a little bit later we're going to actually play one of your pieces, interviews that, it was like a 4-minute interview that you appeared on RT. Around Kaplan, so we'll be definitely getting into the for-profit industry. But I wanted to initially get your response in terms of I've had a lot of folks that are going through it right now, comrades of mine that went to school and including myself who are now faced with these exorbitant, and it's just they're not going away, Danny. I mean, like even my case, I can't even make a dent on the interest, and mine is not even as close to being as bad as some of my friends and even other folks, and it's you can't wipe it away through bankruptcy. Can you shed some light, like what is the gravity, like what are we looking at in terms of the numbers out there in terms of student loan debt that's floating around in America, and how much of that is facing default, and what does this mean in the grand scheme of things regarding education?
All right, well, let's back up a little bit and see if we can go a little slow here. To begin with, we have to understand coming out of World War II, colleges and universities were free. So if we want to talk about just colleges and universities in our educational discussion right now, and leaving out primary and secondary schools, college and universities were free. Veterans got a GI Bill. They went to school. They paid no tuition. In the state of California where I live, this took place all the way up into the 70s. And in the 70s, they started imposing what they called tuition. There never was tuition at the University of Berkeley. So it started to imposing tuition on colleges, universities. The tuition for the junior colleges, of course, was low. It could have been $50 a semester to take 12 units. The tuition on a state college when I went in 1974 was $87.50, and that would cover 12 units. and the tuition at a university, University of Berkeley, was basically free. So that runs true in the veins throughout the country. And that's a result, of course, of struggles for universal education that go back 150 years. Basically, the question then becomes at issue is why would students need to borrow money to go to free universities? And the question is answered in the early 70s in California. Reagan began to impose fees. Now, it was one of Nixon's – there's a couple of reasons involved. I think there are cultural reasons and financial reasons. Let's take the cultural reasons first. Coming into the early 1970s, when Nixon was in power, one of his advisors advised Nixon that the proletariat, meaning the working class who are going to college free, can't really have too much education, because if you give them too much education, they'll do what they did in the 60s. They'll start organizing, and they'll take over campuses, and they'll do anti-war movements and civil rights movements and things like that. So an ideological decision was made at that time that, wait, well, hold on, this free university stuff is no good. We've got to limit who gets into the corridors of power, and we have to make sure that people really are illiterate, not literate. We do not want to spread this disease. We never want to see a 1960s civil rights movement again. And the working class was very clear on this, and I have the quotes if anybody wants to email me and all the sources for what I'm saying. But secondly, on a financial reason, is that coming out of the 1970s, capitalism really began to go into a severe crisis. We've had a number of crises. 1870s was a crisis. We had a crisis in the 1920s, and we had a crisis once again in the 1970s, and of course we're having the greatest depression in the world's history right now. So when capitalism gets into crisis, it's usually for one reason. It's because they have so much surplus money, they don't know where to invest it. Now, the automobile saved the United States for a long time because the automobile helped create suburbs, and suburbs helped create ancillary products, washing machines, all this kind of stuff. So the automobile and, you know, capital construction. But basically, if you're a capitalist and you're sitting on $1 trillion, where are you going to invest it to make a profit? And in today's world, that's what capitalism is about. It's not about saving money or hoarding money. It's about consistently investing to maximize profits. And you have the money has to be invested, consistently moving to maximize profits. Well, the sad story is that industrial America is over, and capitalism, some time ago, perhaps around the 1980s, as Reagan came into power, began to financialize. And now 40% of all capitalist economic activity in this country is not investment in hospitals or in products or in innovation. 40% of all of capitalism is financialization. And you saw this in the subprime mortgages where they sold, you know, insurance on bad loans. And they came up with 100 different financial instruments, and these were then products. Commodified and sold for fees, brokerage fees, and people on the stock exchange made money. It's called FIRE, F-I-R-E, and it means finance, insurance, real estate, and education. Those are now where the money is to be made. Well, education, if it's a public option, which it has been in this country due to the struggle, meaning that it's public education. All right, public education for kindergarten, public education for grammar school, for whatever, secondary, and public education for community colleges, state colleges, and universities. Well, if it's public education, and that means that the public, we have a public commons. Well, the last thing that capitalism wants, number one, is a public commons. They want to privatize everything. And where is the money to be made right now? Education. It's a $500 billion industry. And so if you look at the Hoover Institute or literal Hoover Institute or the Hudson Institute or the Cato Institute, go back to the 1980s and look at their discussions about opening up the educational market. That's what they call it. It's a market to them. Education needs to be commodified and bought and sold on the capitalist free market fundamentalist Wall Street market so that the hedge fund operators, Wall Street, the banks can make money. And it's a $500 billion industry, and it's one of the untapped industries that's left, and so it's being corporatized. And the reason is because the capitalists need to deposit their money somewhere and make money, and this is one of the best things they can do. So what goes on? Well, what you have is you have a number of things that happen. When capitalism is in crisis or as a result of right-wing policies, and then I'll stop and let you ask any questions in just a second, you have, now we're living in what's called the age of austerity. All right. Much like the Greeks or anywhere around the world, we now have to bail out the bankers who stole all the money on Wall Street. We're thinking worldwide, $72 trillion in theft. All right. And all over the world, they're being bailed out by working people. And since working people don't have money to bail them out, they have to bail them out by giving up their social programs, their so-called safety net. The social contract that was made with capitalism after World War II is a result of the New Deal. It was a contract where unions were acceptable. 50 to 1 of a corporate pay was okay. Now it's 500 to 1, and unions are 12% of the population. All right. So there's an attempt to repeal the New Deal, and that means destroying every safety net possible. And that means getting rid of the public commons. And in this case, it means getting rid of public education. So a public education has been starved, number one. Number two, the money that has gone to public education, even though you'll hear some people yelling, well, you know, we give so much money to public education, when you break it down, 4% of it goes to capital projects. On a national level, if you include secondary and primary. If you really look at a pie chart and broke it down, the money we give to education, the majority of it doesn't go to instruction for students, nor does it go to teacher salaries. The majority of it goes to administrators, you know, well-heeled corporate executives, bonuses, capital construction projects that benefit cronies, debt that has to be taken out in the form of bonds that has to be paid off into perpetuity. And so as a result, you look at the educational pie chart, you see that students receive very little. And teachers, and especially now in the age of adjuncts, when there really are no more teacher unions on a college level, or they're disappearing rapidly, there's very few tenure tracks, education is being bought and sold as a product. And so by destroying the public sphere, tuition rises. And tuition now, for example, at Cal Berkeley is $12,000 a year. That doesn't include the cost of, you know, having to live and buy books, et cetera, et cetera. If you want to get in the corridors of power, get into, for example, Harvard, look at least $50,000 a year, and that might include just a bit of your living expenses. So there's a cultural need to bar the access to the corridors of power, okay, to those privileged and elite. And number two, there's a social necessity in the era of austerity and the economic policies under which we live to cut further and further back on social public commons in an attempt to keep the system afloat. And that's what all this deficit is talking about. So that's where I would start, and I'll give the floor to you. And I know I haven't answered your question specifically, but I think it's important for your public to understand that this so-called public education ain't public.
Right, exactly. I want to start off with just this number that, you know, and I got from reading one of your pieces and you know, having conversations with you off air, where it just, I mean, you know, my jaw dropped when I learned of this figure. You know, you said something, there was something like $1 trillion of student loan debt that's floating out there. Is that still so?
The student loan debt in totality. Now we have to understand we have to define terms. So what is student loan debt? So let's take it really carefully. So let's say that I want to go to the University of Maryland, and I'm a working class kid, and so my parents really can't throw in much money. They don't have any of these fancy college plans saved for me, and so, you know, they work for a living, or I'm a single mom or a single father, whatever. In other words, you know, I'm my parents are working, but they're working class people. I want to go to college. I've been accepted to the University of Maryland. The only way that I can pay the tuition, whatever it happens to be, in a public institution or a private institution, are two ways. One is to take out a direct Stafford student loan. A direct Stafford student loan is issued right now by the federal government. It used to be issued through an intermediary called a bank or Sallie Mae, but Obama changed that, trying to get the public to believe that he was taking the bankers out of the process. But as you'll hear in a minute, he didn't, and it's all just an appearance over reality. But so you get a direct Stafford student loan, and then the other way is to apply for what's called a Pell Grant. So 90% of the cost of tuition will be offset by those two. Now, the Pell Grant doesn't have to be paid back. So the majority of what does have to be paid back is what's called the direct Stafford student loan. Okay, it's an unsubsidized or subsidized loan. You're right, it cannot be discharged in bankruptcy. It follows one around like a dirty smell for the rest of their life. But besides that, the amount that is owed now in student loans as a result of direct Stafford student loans, okay, issued through the federal government, exceeds $1 trillion. And that means that it exceeds the entire amount owed by every United States citizen in credit card debt. Now, this is very important for two reasons. One, it's private debt that the student has taken on, and the student can either make a decision to, one, default or to pay it back. But if the student defaults, okay, that $1 trillion was taxpayer money, and so we pay for it as taxpayers. See, that money wasn't issued through, a J&R bank on the corner, or a group of people didn't come up with the money for the tuition to be loaned. It's taxpayer money. So it comes out of an allocation from the general fund to the Department of Education, which then makes a certain amount available for Stafford loans, with the idea that the student will graduate and pay the loans back on a certain fee schedule. Now, here's the incredible part, is not only is the loans over $1 trillion, the interest rate on the loans is usurious in the climate within which we live. I can right now go out and get a loan to buy a home on a 30-year mortgage at 2.8%. But if I have a Stafford loan, I'm paying 7.8% on my student loan, which is almost three times the amount of borrowing a home for a mortgage. So not only is the product being bought and sold, but the interest rate for the banksters and which stand behind the government are just absolutely phenomenal.
Unbelievable. Oh, my God.
Now, the incredible, unbelievable part about it, okay, is that it's never going to be paid back. And that's what people really have to realize. So right now, there's a whole bunch of people eating at the trough. You see, what you're beginning to see with this really rabid market fundamentalism, this no-hold-bars neoliberalism that deregulates when it's favorable to the capitalist ruling class, and then re-regulates when it's favorable to the capitalist ruling class. For example, Joe Biden was part and parcel of the Bankruptcy Act that re-regulated bankruptcy and purposely said that students couldn't declare bankruptcy because they knew that this $1 trillion worth of debt would be added on to the general debt that we already owe, which is $15 trillion. So if the U.S. owes $15 trillion and $2 trillion is from off books, wars that are off books, and another $2 trillion is owed through the Bush tax cuts, and another $1 trillion is owed as a result of the bailouts, that's $5 trillion, and another $1 trillion is owed due to the student loan debt, that's $6 trillion. Okay, where is the money? And the money, very easily said, the money is in the hands of 450 families. And that's where it is. And the government aids and abets this. It's basically selling America off on the installment plan. We're selling our economy on the installment plan. Now, these students will never be able to pay the debt. They're living at home with their parents. Okay, the debt is due 270 days after you graduate or are no longer enrolled. If you're one day over, you're in default. Once you go into default, and some of your listeners may remember the term that was coined by I can't remember exactly who it was, a very astute person who said you live what's called social death. You fall into what is called social death. And social death basically means if you have an unpaid student loan, you can't rent an apartment, you can't get a credit card, can't open up a bank account, right? You have no economic life. You're marginalized on the edges of society. You can't engage in economic life, okay, because it's the first thing that shows up. They'll garnish not only all your wages that you ever make, but if you live long enough to get Social Security, they will garnish your Social Security checks at age 55. We've got gray hairs walking around in their mid-40s that are still paying their student loans. This is debt peonage.
Jeez.
That's what we're talking about. A disposable society of youth. And the whole culture, of course, has encouraged this. First of all, it is true that if you have a college education, you make approximately 77% more than somebody that has a high school education in America today. Those are statistics as of the last 3 years. So, you know, if you have a college education and I don't, chances are you're going to make 77% more than I do. Unless, of course, I'm a plumber, an electrician, or something like that. But just your average working Joe, you will make more than I do. Therefore, what has capitalism created? It's created a system where you have to go into debt the rest of your life in order to wage labor for the rest of your life. In order to sell your wages on the market for the rest of your life, you must go into debt for the rest of your life. Because if you don't go into debt, you can't get the college degree. If you don't get the college degree, you can't earn the 77% more as a wage laborer. So they're actually selling the diplomas and degrees as commodities. Okay, and because they've set the system up that you can't rise in your organization unless you have an MA. You can't get a good job unless you have a BA. You can't, and so these things are no longer public. You have to buy them. They're products. You go to the store and you buy them like shampoo. Some shampoo is 99 cents. Other shampoo is $4.59.
So they're basically tagging almost just like the subprime crisis. They're packaging up these this student loan debt and basically selling it off.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, it gets funded through treasuries and all kinds of shenanigans. But yeah, they're printing money and basically loading it to students at usurious rates. Us telling them that we set up a system for you where you'll either go to jail or you'll go into gangs or you'll go into the military or you'll go get a college degree and you'll become a wage serf. But in order to become a wage serf, you're going to need this degree. We've turned it into a commodity. So pick out on the shelf which one you can afford. If you can't afford any of them, then we've got a place where you can go buy and borrow money to afford them. But, of course, once you borrow the money, it's going to be astronomical. You'll graduate with $60,000 in debt, and then you'll spend the first 15 years of your life trying to pay it all off and raise a family, and try to keep a relationship together and try to, survive. And, of course, it's unsustainable. It can't happen. And so the defaults will begin to start to multiply. It's the next bubble. It's like the housing bubble. It's called a subprime education. And that's when you get into the for-profits, which we can talk about. And they offer basically a subprime education. They're traded on Wall Street right on, the index. And we can talk about them. They're a whole different issue. They're thriving now because of the decimation of the common public sphere. Students can't get seats in universities. The universities are going broke, so they're selling their seats to the rich Chinese and Indians from Asia. Okay, you go take a look at Obama's last trip to East Asia. I wrote about this Daily Censored. The president of Rutgers went with him. The president of Columbia went with him. Why? Because students here can't afford to go into debt, and they can't get into the classes. They're too much money. Well, sell them to the rich Chinese. They don't need Stafford loans. They don't need Pell Grants. They pay in cash, and they pay out a residency fees, and a seat's a seat, so just sell it to them.
Right.
And that's what's happening. You look at schools, and a great majority are foreign exchange students that are just coming in to get a Berkeley education and flying home to China. We've outsourced our education, not just as a product, basically.
And so it's almost like a debt of society because, you know, as you said, you know, yeah, you know, people with college degrees, they make 77% more than on average than somebody without a college degree. But there's, as you know, there's a mass of people out there who have college degrees, some even with postgraduate degrees that are quite literally living check to check. And some, you know, and many that are even living, you know, under the, you know, the so-called poverty line. And,
well, this
and,
is the cruel hoax.
In their eyeballs.
This is the cruel hoax. This is the cruel hoax that's been perpetrated on an unsuspecting public, and that is the narrative. You know, it's the same narrative for the ownership society that Bush peddled on us that led us down to the subprime mortgage black hole. And that is, you know, get a college degree, you'll hit the American dream, there'll be plenty of jobs for you, you'll be able to pay it back, and you'll live happy, and you can buy more stuff. Okay? Well, unfortunately, there are no jobs. And there's four people applying for each one. Okay? And a college degree is what we call bupkis in Yiddish. It just means nothing at this point. There are no jobs. 30% of the students live with their parents, for God's sakes. They graduate and they're moving in. You know, we're going to be living like our great great grandparents. And as you said to me in an email, your great great grandparents lived as slaves. Yeah, well, you know, people's great great grandparents who weren't black, for example, lived as serfs and peasants. No social security, no safety net, no education, no nothing.
Right.
Just debt.
Right.
And no job and no way to pay it back. See, that's what capitalism's created, a terrible disaster for itself. So who will pay it back? Will pay it back by because they will cut more social services to pay the trillion.
And what kind of effect will that have on the economy? You know,
it can have many different outcomes historically. You know, there's really no way of predicting in a crystal ball. If you look at Europe right now in the breakup of the Eurozone, and you look at the same problems that students in England, for example, are saddled with debt, they can't get into college. I mean, basically, it's a disposable youth population. We have a surplus population of people that will never work again under capitalism. As technology becomes more sophisticated, and as more and more outsourcing continues, the banana republic starts to emerge bigger and bigger and bigger, and then we just, you know, the narrative then just begins to accept 14% unemployment. You know, it becomes a new norm. Already the Obama administration is so happy that it's down to 8.1. It's like the new norm. Soon it'll be 14% will be the new norm, all right? And then, like I say, then the deracinated youth, you know, will look, you know, outside with a bleary eye and say, you know, what am I living for? Suicide rates go up, drug use goes up, affiliations with gangs go up, joining the military is one only way to get, you know, to get any, three hots and a cot goes up, or ending up in the prison industrial system goes up as everything becomes commodified. And so a form of social death just takes place, because civilian life becomes absolutely decimated. There becomes no civilian life. It's a hand-to-hand combat life. You know, none for all and all for none. So you know, the prospects can, at that time, then we need to start talking, what is economics, an economic situation like that produce? Well, it's historically produced fascism. I mean, you know, Hitler capitalized off of the decimation of Germany in World War One. You know, when the money was worth nothing and people had no jobs, and they turned around and blamed Jews, Romanians, Gypsies, or the mentally disabled, you know, and came up with, you know, his own breed of fascism. Mussolini, the same thing. Franco, the same thing. Okay, I mean, Tito in Japan, the same thing. I mean, you have a movement from, we're not in fascism now, we live in an authoritarian state. But one consequence can be fascism, and that is taking these youth and putting them into, you know, a right-wing civilian corps within the United States. New brown shirts. Another outcome can be more optimistic and more favorable, and that is we have more Occupy Movement types of things, more education, the internet is used and not shut down on us, and we're able to mobilize and organize. But I think that people have to understand this is an international problem now. This is not relegated to the United States. It can't be solved in the U.S.
Right.
It can't. There's no way.
And I like I like the way that when you opened up, you gave this historical context, letting folks know that, you know, there was a time in America where, you know, tertiary education was subsidized. It was free, you know, and even when it moved past that, it was very much affordable. Looking at today, you know, for those, you know, anyone that's listening right now, Danny, that's saying, well, you know, what are the alternatives? Are there? Can you let folks know that there are other countries out there, say Norway, and a rack of other countries, where in 2012 their states actually subsidize education, where it's either affordable.
Let's take one that's really close. I mean, let's take one that we'll talk about the global north and the global south. Okay, I don't like to use the word third world anymore. It's the global south and the global north. In the global northern countries like the United States, okay, you take a country like Sweden. Okay, they not only subsidize every a payment to go to college. Okay, they pay students to go to college and give them housing. Now let me repeat that. They pay students to go to college and give them housing. Students don't pay them. Okay, there's no such thing as debt to go to school in Sweden. All right, Finland, very much the same thing, though I don't think they pay students to go to college. Okay, very much so. Your Scandinavian countries who have still have maintained some semblance of what we call social democracy, a contract between the state and the capitalists, so whereby, you know, there's a shortened work week and more vacation time and, you know, a more affordable education. But there are countries like France and England that are having tremendous rebellions right now as they're feeling the financialization of education as well, as capitalism, like a parasite, is looking for another host to suck more and more profits out of. And, of course, that comes from decimating public education and starting private education. So we then get a new provider. Think about health care. We don't have a public option in health care. We have a private option in health care. Well, they want to take away the public option in education and provide you with only a private option in education. And that's where Kaplan College comes in, and Corinthian College, and Phoenix University, and DeVry Institute, and every one of the subprime educational institutions. Okay, they're subprime because they don't deliver an education, number one. They commodify everything. They sell diplomas. That's all they do. I call this basically the pedagogy of poverty and the poverty of pedagogy. It's the pedagogy of poverty because we must understand from an educational point of view what poverty is doing to our youth and our society. But at the same token, it's the poverty of pedagogy because we must understand that what's being taught in schools is not critical thinking. It's not thinking about history. It's not, you know, there's no historical or critical thinking involved in schools anymore. They're basically boot camps for learning how to keystroke for the cyber revolution. Just like people in the Industrial Revolution went to school, what did they learn? They learned how to read English so that they could follow the manuals and the new factories that were built. Okay, you needed workers that could read plans, follow manuals, read timesheets. That's the only reason they got an education. It's not because capitalism wanted them to be educated. All right? It's the same thing with the cyber revolution. People used to go to college in the 1950s that could afford to, or that were the right color or the right ethnicity. They went to college for a contemplative experience. And out of that came a revolution amongst college kids. Okay, they go to school now to survive, and they're not even able to do that. So what's being taught in schools is so bad. They're just dungeons of despair where you're just benched, you know, for years until you end up on a conveyor belt, usually to prison because, you know, you threw an eraser at somebody or you threatened a teacher or, yeah. So you've got private prisons and you've got private health care and now you're going to have private education. And sure, and this is the society that you get. You get a very, very, very sick society of social death, of a surplus population that will never live, or as Angela Davis says so well, the commodity has penetrated every aspect of people's lives without any historical precedent. You know, and I encourage people to read her book, Abolition Democracy, Beyond Empire, Prisons and Torture, because she says it so well, because the people that are being hurt the most are the most disenfranchised in our communities, people of color, black people, brown people, working class people, you know.
Right.
So.
And yeah, thank you so much for that, Danny. I want to play this clip. It's actually you, and I want to, you know, I think it's a perfect segue to basically actually I'm going to play this clip, and once the clip is over, it's very short, but I want you to if you can expound upon this whole for-profit university phenomenon. It's this parasite that's also sucking the blood out of millions of people. So I'm going to play this real quick from Russia Today.
Alrighty.
This, of course, a touchy subject, particularly here in Washington, as the government has just put down some harsh regulations against for-profit universities. Dr. Danny Weil is an investigative journalist, a professor, and also an author. He wrote this book, Charter School Movement, History, Politics, Policies, Economics, and Effectiveness. Hey there, Dr. Weil. Let's first talk about what's going on right now in terms of trying to rein in the corruption at these for-profit universities. You know, late last year, the U.S. Department of Education said these universities needed to do several things to reform their ways. They needed to stop what they called deceptive advertising. They needed to stop paying recruiters based on how many students they enroll. And they needed to ensure that only eligible students and programs received aid. And we've just learned the Association of Private Sector Colleges and Universities filed a lawsuit to prevent these rules from going into effect. So, Dr. Weil, are these rules fair?
Well, first of all, as I wrote in truthout.com, you can't regulate a criminal enterprise, and Kaplan University certainly qualifies as a criminal enterprise. Its job for the last 10 years has been to acquire colleges that have accreditation already, much like a liquor license is acquired by personal owners who don't want to have to go through the liquor license process. And then they have set up a system where they predate students. There is absolutely no doubt that Kaplan University is works very much like a mafia, and as you indicated, it's owned by the Washington Post. Now, the role of the federal government right now, according to Arne Duncan and those in the federal government, is attempt to regulate this this enterprise called Kaplan University, and with all due fairness, for-profit colleges in general. There are over 2,000 of them, Kaplan being one of the largest. The issue is can you regulate a criminal enterprise? Can you regulate a home robbery or home invasion? Can you regulate a sexual assault? And the answer is no. These organizations run for only one reason, and that is to increase shareholder profits, and it just can't be regulated.
I want to talk about the lobbying that happens, not just here in Washington on K Street, but also on the editorial pages of the Washington Post. How can this go on? How can this paper continue to do this and have people not really calling them out?
Well, the newspaper that ironically brought us Watergate has now brought us EduGate. And EduGate is basically a cover-up of what's going on, not just with Kaplan College, which is 58% of all the revenue of the Washington Post. Let's be honest and fair, 105 newspapers folded within the last 18 months in the United States. The Washington Post was not one of them. The reason is they get $2.6 billion from their Kaplan subsidiaries, $1.46 billion from Kaplan University alone, of which 83% of that is money that we, the taxpayers, give them in the form of Title IV loans. They have found a way to extract from us as taxpayers money for a gimmick they call for-profit colleges, where the default rate is so high, we now have $896 billion and outstanding student loans.
I want to kind of piggyback on something that you're saying. I mean, it's a little disturbing to me because this seems part of a larger trend. In so many ways, it's one of those buy now, pay later incidents. Just like banks, just like prospective home buyers, these students are signing up for something they can't afford and will not be able to pay back. I mean, do you think it's possible that following the housing bubble and the banking bubble, that this, the education bubble, will be the next one to pop?
Absolutely. This is going to be the next Wall Street bubble that's going to burst. The financialization of the United States economy has forced these capitalists to put their money into for-profit colleges. In the year 2000, Kaplan only received $35 million a year from their institution. They are now up to $1.4 billion. As our public institutions fail, they come in with disaster economics. They tell students this is the only way they can get a job. They sell phony degrees like culinary degrees for $80,000 a year, and they have driven up the debt in the United States that will be defaulted on to close to $1 trillion. You add to this $1 trillion of credit card debt, and you have students by the age of 26 that have mortgaged their life to a system of debt feudalism.
Certainly interesting as well when you hear the ways that they've been advertising for these universities, driving cars with advertisements through housing projects like ice cream trucks, leaving brochures at food stamp offices. You got to think that something strange is going on here. Dr. Danny Weil, investigative journalist, professor, and author.
And that was Danny. And while the clip was playing, I think we momentarily lost Danny again on a connection probably on his end. So as we, wait for Danny to call back in, I just wanted to, that interview that you just heard was several months ago on Russia Today, which is, one of the better media outlets that is not offered by the U.S., but, it plays into how fast this crisis is growing, because that interview that Danny gave, as I said, was several months ago, and not on that interview he was quoted in saying it was something like $850 billion in student loans that were out there floating around and facing default, and now we're looking at over $1 trillion. That's how quickly it's growing. And I think Danny really elucidated that point rather well. And so Danny's back with us. Danny, that piece that you did on RT exposing Kaplan, which is owned by the Washington Post company, but there are also other players out there like Phoenix. Can you talk about, some of these players, these for-profit colleges, and who are they mostly preying on? Why are they being compared to the vultures that really sparked up the subprime mortgage crisis?
All right. Well, again, we need to understand them as an institution that exists under a larger system called capitalism. Capitalism is a system that puts profits before people, and that for maximizing profits is the goal, and in fact the fiduciary duty of anybody that is a CEO in any capitalist venture. Their fiduciary duty they have in their articles of incorporation is to maximize profits. So understood that that's a system that we're talking about within which they exist. Well, as I mentioned earlier, there have been cuts, small, tiny cuts that have taken place over decades now of starving public education. And the starving of public education on all levels has led to a situation where public education is, one, either too costly, or two, it doesn't have enough programs or seats available to students. So at the community college where I teach, for example, they want students to they want me to teach online, and they want me to take 100 students in a course. Well, of course, I won't do that, number one. But number two, if you're a student that goes to brick-and-mortar school, you sign up for courses, you're basically scrambling under a pinata for candy with a bunch of other kids trying to figure out who can get more candy. There are no courses available for students in many – they've cut so many programs in colleges. So this is where the for-profits come in. They're like private pike, which is a fish. A pike is a fish. Private pike in a public lake. A pike is a fish that eats other fish. So if you put private pike in a public lake, they'll eat all your public fish, and all that will be left are private pike. And that's what they are. They are a $30 billion industry in the United States right now. Okay, and they're represented by all the colleges we mentioned earlier, from Corinthian to Phoenix, from Kaplan to educational management. I mean, their names vary, of course, and but they're all the same. They're traded on the New York Stock Exchange. They have actually a shareholder value, just like for-profit prisons, and their job is to commodify, turn into a thing or product, education, and then sell it and make a profit off of it. And that's what they do. Of course, under neoliberal economics, which is a word that I want the listeners to understand, it's not just some large word. It means where the government has been hijacked to serve only the interest of the elite. and therefore the politicians, the coin-operated politicians, the public policy, the various departments of education, energy, et cetera, are all occupied by privatizers and Wall Street interests. And they love the government because they turn the government into a corporate boardroom. That's what we have now. We don't have a government in the United States. We have a corporate boardroom. And so in the corporate boardroom, okay, they pass laws that say that the for-profit colleges are allowed to get the benefit of Title IV loans. And those are the loans I mentioned earlier, the Stafford loans. So the student goes to says, I want to go to Kaplan University because they've got a program in criminal justice, and my local junior college, I either can't drive there because the freeways are congested, or I don't have public transportation, or I can't afford a car, the gasoline's at $4, or it's just not, I'm raising kids, I can't go to, you know, to a brick and mortar, my local junior college. Which now is even getting more and more expensive and has less and less programs. Or in the alternative, my local junior college's nursing program is filled, or their criminal justice program is filled. Well, Kaplan says as it taps you on the shoulder, you know, with its scythe, and, you know, and its death skull, you know, we're a college too. And we can sell you an education. We know that you need to buy an education to make it in the capitalist economy. And so they have recruiters that go out and sell it. So this $30 billion industry right now, the default rate for Kaplan College, the default rate for all public profit colleges, 22.4%. That means 23% of all the students that go to for-profit colleges default. Now, you compare that with, let's say, a public college. It's only 9.7%. So why is it three times the amount? Because the for-profit college recruits homeless people, drug addicts. They leave their literature at public housing units. They prey on minorities, and especially black single women with children. They love to prey on black women. In fact, they're staffed mostly with Latino and black women so that they can resonate the narrative that even though you're minority and you're black in the United States, you too can become part of the capitalist dream. All you need to do is come to Kaplan College, and we have everything that's ready for you. Well, of course, you know, the cost of a college education at Kaplan College, as I mentioned, could be $80,000. And that same cost at a regular college, just 20 or 30 years ago, would have been free. So these colleges have found a real big in here. But here's the interesting part. You want to just talk about Kaplan College alone? Okay, let's just talk about Kaplan College alone. Between 2003 and 2008, Kaplan College paid its CEOs $230
billion.
Jeez. Let me repeat that. Between 2003 and 2008, Kaplan College paid one quarter of a billion dollars, excuse me, one quarter of $1 billion, okay, to its CEOs, all right? Now, where does that quarter of $1 billion come from? Well, that's the Title IV money they got from the government. They get 91% of all their revenue from the United States government in the form of the loans the student take out. They robo-sign those loans, by the way, right at the college, just like those fraudulent deeds to the homes were robo-signed at Wells Fargo and nobody can find out who really owns the deed. Same thing's going on at these colleges. They get you in, and then they get you signed up for financial aid, and then they get the check mailed directly to them. They put the check directly into their bank account. They pay out proceeds and to their shareholders. Okay, let's take a look at Donald Graham of the Washington Post, who owns Kaplan College. All right, he's the CEO of the Washington Post, and by the way, he's also the recruiting member for the Federal City Council in Washington, D.C., where you're close to, which is a very prestigious of city council. I don't know if you know about it. Anyway, old Donnie, okay, he paid out $76 million about 3 weeks ago to a 29-year-old CEO executive, and for himself and his family, okay, within the last 2 years, he and his family dumped stock, okay, in Kaplan College and Washington Post worth $76 million. Right? So these people are just eating at the public trough, but they're not eating with a fork and knife. They're eating and ladling it out with shovels, as much taxpayer money as they can get. And then they're selling all their stocks. Here's the Phoenix Institute. This is one your readers will be acquainted with. They're on every freeway off-ramp you can imagine. You've seen them, the freeways, the Phoenix Institute, another what I call predatory college. And they're predatory college. They're disaster colleges is the best really term for it. John Sperling is a major stockholder in Phoenix University, which is called the Apollo Group. He and his family just cashed in $127 million in stock. Okay? They just cashed it in a couple of weeks ago. Meanwhile, what's the graduation rate in D.C. where you live? 6-7% of all students at the University of Phoenix graduate. 93% don't graduate, and the family just sold $127 million in stock that was artificially inflated and is made up of our taxpayer money. Where's the austerity program for the rich?
Right. That's right. Unbelievable.
So they're getting corralled into going to these schools, again being told you need a college education. Okay, well, I went down to my local school and I can't get in Berkeley. Okay, we'll try the community, try the state college. Well, I went there and the programs are closed. Okay, we'll try the community college. Well, I did my 60 units and I've transferred them already and I need to start my upper division and there's no place that has any college for me. And then that's these people rub their greasy little hands and they get you in. But that's just tuition. Then there are fees. Remember, with every product, there's shipping and handling. Okay, and they used to say there's three things are certain. Two things are certain in life: death and taxes. Now you can say there are three things certain in life: death, taxes, and shipping and handling. Okay, there's shipping and handling that goes with a degree in the form of fees. You need a fee to get the diploma, and then there's a fee to get a background check, and then there's a fee to get to graduate, and then there's a $100 fee to pass this exam, and then there's a $700 fee. So they've created a whole new language. On one side of their mouth, they talk about tuition, and on the other side of their mouth, they talk about fees. Okay? And they had to do this because they're only allowed to get a certain amount from the government for tuition. So they have to call it tuition, and then they can cash it in at the federal bank window, and they can get their tax money. And anything else that are fees will be taken out by student loans, parent loans, personal loans, loans from the bank, predatory loans from payday checks, or many students, sign over the title to their cars, just to make the payment. When I was at the Phoenix Institute or university about 4 weeks ago, I was interviewing both students, teachers, and workers there for about a day. They're located in a mortgage building next to some title company. They're not campuses. Their vending machines is all they have. And the Student Resource Center, inside the Student Resource Center, the couple of black women were sitting behind the desk, and they were watching on television in closed caption on must have been a monstrous, 50-inch screen, The Prize is Right. This is in the Student Resource Center. There was another young man walking around mumbling to himself, and when I talked to another young man, he told me he was homeless, and he had gotten a student loan, and he's able to use the bathroom at the so-called university campus to take baths while he pursues his criminal justice degree. I don't know how much grimmer you want me to paint it. I mean, it's just deadening. It's deadening. And what's even worse is it's supported by Democrats. It could never have taken place under a Republican government ever.
Right.
Okay. So you have Jesse Jackson comes out in favor of the predatory for-profit colleges and argues with Arne Duncan at Department of Education that they shouldn't be regulated. Nancy Pelosi comes out in favor of Phoenix University after she takes money from Phoenix University for a campaign and says that the for-profit colleges shouldn't be regulated. All right, so it's the Democrats that are working night and day, both as lobbyists and inside the government, to protect these for-profit college predators, right? Because they know the entire public system is going down the drain. They know this is where the money is to be made right now, and they're just unbelievable.
Right. Well, I didn't think we could get much grimmer, but I think that this transition,
I want to get younger, and I think this may be a more grim, diagnosis of public education in America. If we could take a step back and keep in the same vein with Democrats, Republicans, the likes of, let's say Al Sharpton, Barack Obama, Arnie Duncan. We take a step back to primary and secondary education, and this whole charter school, this great thing that's been painted, this charter school thing, and so many Americans are confused about this. So many Americans that it's impacting their communities most negatively, the way it's been sold to them, and it's not like they don't have the best intention for their children, but it's been sold to them like this is a great thing. So I've heard so many folks just defending, this charter school thing, and then I explain it to them what's going on, and it's like shocking to them. Can you explain why this whole the race to the top and this whole charter school movement that has been backed by likes of, that's created these unusual bedfellows like Newt Gingrich and Al Sharpton, why the charter school, this charter school movement is the most destructive one when looking at public education, and especially public education in inner city communities?
Well, again, I'm going to go back to the caption that I spoke of before, and that is the whole notion of the poverty of education and the education of poverty. Let's begin first the poverty of education. What many teachers are finding that is that their students aren't learning anything in schools. I mean, you see, I think that we need a new narrative, those of us that are looking for a liberatory education, that believe education is, in the words of W.E.B. Du Bois, when he wrote his 10 moments, I don't know if you, his 10th, I don't have it in front of me. Yeah, I mean, he talks about education very specifically, and we can get into that in a few minutes. But the bottom line is, as many parents are finding that public education, okay, due to the fact that there is so much poverty, and that public education has been cut, and that spending in public education basically finds its way redistributed upwards, or to textbook companies, or contracted out to various companies or services schools, then the education in public schools is for many people is really not that good. Now, you add to that the fact that the media has demonized public education, okay, and unjustly so, I believe, because I'm a public school teacher, and I've taught public school in inner cities and migrant communities and all over. So I'm for public education, obviously so. Okay, but it's not enough to be for public education. One has to be for a public education that is aimed toward teaching people to think critically. And the pedagogy of the poverty of the pedagogy is that we're still in an anorexic bulimic learning model of outcome based standards, and passing standardized tests, and learning what I call official knowledge, not being aware of the hidden curriculum in textbooks, of who we get history from the voices of the conquerors but not the conquered, from the franchised but not the disenfranchised. And education is basically, I don't call it education anymore. I call it schooling under capitalism. There's a big difference between public education and schooling under capitalism. And schooling under capitalism, whether it's in a public setting, is basically a sorting machine. It's to sort people out as to who goes to college and who gets into power and who gets into this club and who gets into that club. With the rich abandoning public education in favor of private schools, and with the defunding of public education and passing of laws such as Proposition 13, can't raise taxes without 2/3 majority in California, there's no way to, we just got $1 billion cut from half a billion from primary and secondary education here in California, teachers laid off en masse. Okay, this opens up both an opportunity for a narrative by the privatizers and venture capitalists, as well as an actual on-the-ground material conditions to put together their business plan. And that is what they've been hawking for a long time.
You know, they want a voucher for education. Just like Ryan wants a voucher for Medicare, he doesn't want Medicare anymore. He doesn't want a public Medicare program. He wants to give you a public voucher that you go give to a private provider. That's what they want in education. They want vouchers, all right, the ruling class, because that's how they'll make more money. They get their money directly that way. They don't have to jimmy around with different localities. Just give us a federal voucher, and we can just give that voucher to them, and then they'll give us a second-rate education. But see, vouchers didn't fly. They tried vouchers to sell it in the 90s, and there was a big upheaval in Milwaukee especially about it. And vouchers weren't liked in D.C. very much. And vouchers have not been liked, and they have definitely not worked anywhere where they've been tried. So what did they do? They turned around, and to capitalize off the disgruntled parents and to capitalize off starving of the public educational institutions and their inability to, their teacher-to-student ratios, their inability to provide up-to-date textbooks, technology, and a decent learning environment, you know, with a decent pedagogy, they said, look, you know, why don't you come on over to us? We're going to do a charter school. A charter school is basically, you know, a private school that's subsidized through public funds. And it's a lure, and especially for people of color in inner-city urban areas where they're peddled most. It's a subprime education again. Okay, basically, you know, the charter school is all based on Arne Duncan's Race to the Top, and all you do in charter schools, all teachers do in charter schools is they get kids ready for tests, and all kids do in charter schools is get ready to take tests, all right? Now, certainly there's different socioeconomic levels of charter schools. If you live in a suburb, you know, if you go to your child's in the French charter school, you know, that's going to be more affluent than if you're in a charter chain. Okay, and by charter chain, I mean that there are companies that own charter chains. That's what they are. They're chains. They're like, you know, McDonald's. You know, you have a franchise here and a franchise there. They're charter chains. They have a standardized curriculum. You know, about 50% of the revenue they bring in goes to education and teachers. The rest goes to profits and marketing. It's like the for-profit colleges. Okay, you know, 30% of every dollar they take in goes to marketing. You know, 25% goes to corporate profits. And 18% goes to this. And then whatever's left of the pie goes to the kids. But it sounds alluring to a lot of parents, especially low socioeconomic parents, because they're rightly scared of a society that's basically unlivable. You can't walk down the streets. You know, there's private security guards and surveillance everywhere. The stop and frisk is, you know, horrendous. I mean, you can't be in an automobile after midnight. I mean, so, parents are worried, and they say, look, you know, the charter school, KIPP or whatever it is across the street, if we can get little Benny in the charter school, and then how do they get him in? They have to be a part of a lottery. You know, they got to go on American Idol, you know, and dance really well to get the kids in, you know. So we actually have a lottery system now, but charters are a Trojan horse, all right? They're the Trojan horse for the real issue, and that's vouchers. See, if you can soften the public up with a bunch of kidney punches, all right, to the idea of privatization through charter schools, then when it comes along to saying, well, look, what do you even need charter schools for? What if we just gave you a voucher worth X amount of money in a year, and then you could decide whether you want to homeschool or whether you want to go to a Christian school or whether you want your kid to go to an Islamic school or whether you want to go to a public school? And that voucher's worth how much, sir? $3,000. Well, how much does the school that I want to go to cost? Well, it costs $6,000, so you'll have to make up the other three.
Right.
That's where we're headed. That's what it's about.
All right. You mentioned something. I've heard a lot about the KIPP schools lately. What's the deal with KIPP schools?
KIPP schools are very, very easy to understand. They basically, what's been created in the United States, unbeknownst to most people, is basically you can look at it as a Peace Corps program. It's called Teach for America. Now, it's been around for about 20 years, and Michelle Rhee, the former chancellor of Washington, D.C., of education, that, you know, who was firing teachers and demonizing teachers and forcing charters and everything else, she was a graduate of Teach for America. Teach for America is the reserve labor army of the capitalist class. While they're busy destroying teachers' unions, they're also busy holding summer camps where bright-eyed kids of about 22, 23 years old can get some of their students' loans forgiven, or they can get a job immediately if they're willing to go teach in bad parts of the city at charter schools like KIPP. Now, it's basically a Walmart model of education. They become call centers. They have to have a cell phone. As a teacher, you have to have a cell phone at all times. All right, you have to be available from like 6 in the morning till 8 in the evening. Students have to be able to call you. Parents have to be able to call you. The days are longer. The amount of time in school is longer. You can't get into school unless the parents sign a pledge. The pledge is very onerous. It says how much time you must spend with a student. If you're a working class person, you can't do a lot of what the pledge asks you to do. You know, it's not just will you read to your kid at night. The pledge is about how much community service you have to put in and da da da. So it's very stringent. This way they cream. And by creaming, they get subprime kids in essence, low-income kids, because every kid they get in is everybody they get in is worth money. The government allocates a certain amount of money for every kid that goes to school. So for the capitalists, they're not kids. Each kid is a certain amount of money. The kids have been commodified. Our youth have been turned into commodities. They are bought and sold every day, from education to their personal information on Facebook. Everything about youth is being sold today, including their dreams and their hopes. So, yeah, so KIPP is basically a boot camp. And it's run by two guys that are Teach for America graduates, and it's made up of Teach for America teachers. The turnover rate is usually 3 years before the teacher burns out, and then they have to get another teacher in. It's not a profession anymore. Teaching is not a profession anymore. It's a Walmart job. You know, Walmart workers last about 3 years, and then they burn out, and they get more Walmart workers. They're low paid. There's no unions, no benefits, vacation time that's paid. You know, it's just basically you're in school every day, all day, preparing for Arne Duncan's standardized tests that have been put together by Bill Gates and that are given electronically through the testing assessment industry.
Wonderful.
Because the testing assessment industry is one of the biggest industries in the United States right now. Nobody grades
right.
by hand. This all gets put into computers, follows you for
right.
life.
Wonderful.
Okay? Yeah, everybody's chipped. And so the testing companies, of course, the textbook companies have turned into software companies. One whole division of the Washington Post is Kaplan Technology. Kaplan Technology will sell, you know, preparation courses online for the SAT test, the GMAT. So make kids take tests, and then you have to sell them products to pass the test.
Right.
Unbelievable. It's all capitalism. The racism comes in and how they divide us and conquer us so we can't see our interests are the same as working people. And, of course, the racism comes in as people of color are hurt much more, you know, both by poverty and educational predation like I'm talking about. You know, so the racism is part and parcel of what the capitalists need. They love racism.
Right.
They need it. It keeps us apart. We can't unite.
Yeah.
God forbid we ever united. So, you know, and of course they need that population that can't get into traditional schools to vamp on. And that's why most of your charter schools are made up of not white kids. You know, if you live in a prestigious area in the suburbs, chances are your public school is all right.
Yeah, right.
Your public school is doing fine.
Yeah.
And when you have
yeah.
garage sales, you know, your public school sells computers and shit. You have a garage sale down in the hood, and your public schools are selling cookies for a quarter of a piece.
Right.
You know, so the whole notion of a garage sale to raise money for your school is completely different from one side of the railroad tracks to another.
You got it.
You know, the class divisions, Solo, are so horrendous. And the disposability of the youth is mounting so greatly. And the parasitic industries traded on Wall Street, from payday loans to check cashing to for-profit colleges. And then the culture that just puts it into people's mind, like the Food Channel telling kids they can be chefs, and then they go out and go to these schools, pay $80,000 in student loans to become a chef, or these surveillance programs to show everybody they can sit in front of a computer and gain weight, get diabetes for the rest of their life, watching other people if they get a degree. You look at the commercials on the television, look at the programs, and this is the digital dark ages. This is the subculture of illiteracy rising now, growing.
Right.
So this is what we have to struggle against.
And the schools, you know, read from your works and folks like Jonathan Kozol and Henry Grow, that, you know, education is like an educational apartheid, right? The school systems are as racially segregated today as they were in the 60s. No?
Oh, absolutely so. And the racial segregation is not only necessarily due to racism itself, it's due to economics. It's due to where, you know, who gets the money and who doesn't get the money. I mean, you know that as well as I do. But yes, it's far worse than it ever was, which means that there's far more division amongst people than there ever was because, you know, people aren't going to school together. And then you get, you know, political candidates, you know, that are basically talking about a return to Plessy versus Ferguson. And so, you know, but I'm looking at The Talented Tenth by W.E.B. Du Bois, and I'm not going to read it to your listeners, but I just want to encapsulate, in 1916 it was written, you know. And you know, he said, if we make money the object of man training, we'll develop money makers, but not man. You know, he said, and if we only make manhood the object of the work of schools, then we're going to lose intelligence, sympathy, knowledge of the world. Education must not simply teach work. It's got to teach life. And, of course, that's what the rulers don't want, Solo. They won't want us to think critically because we'll organize and we will roll out the guillotines once again.
Right. I think it was Dewey that said, you know, education of life is itself. I mean, he had a vastly different view of humanity than did Walter Lippmann.
The real curriculum is life. That is the real curriculum, not the phony ones we set up in school. But you know, you can go back to Antonio Gramsci, you know, who was a victim of Mussolini's fascism, and he said very much the same thing. You know, he said the proletariat needs an educational system that's open to all. You know, system in which a child is allowed to develop and mature and acquire all the features of a humanistic school as conceived of by the ancients and by people of the Renaissance, a school that's of freedom and free initiative, you know, where we're not just preparing people for jobs. Well, of course, you know, Gramsci died in prison, you know. So, critical pedagogy is not appreciated amongst the rulers.
Right.
So we need to change poverty and we need to change pedagogy.
Exactly. And my second to last question I want to ask you, because my last question I want to, you know, transition, I want to ask you, you know, about, you know, tangible solutions that people can start doing right now. But before I ask you that question, I wanted to know, there was a young man that I met that I was very, very fortunate to meet through you by the name of Devon from Detroit, Michigan. And I want my listeners to know, because some folks have asked me about this off air, is the whole Walmart connection. Can you tell the story of story of Devon and how Walmart stuck their reprehensible tentacles into Frederick Douglass High and Detroit Public Schools. And
yes,
you know, radically, you know, and you can link it to, you know, also why the rulers, it's important for the rulers to have a curricula that is devoid of any critical thinking.
Okay, well, basically, again, you've got failing schools in Detroit. The price of homes is tumbled. They've lost 50% minimum of their value. They're blowing up and destroying homes in Detroit. The car manufacturers have gone out of business. Well, the schools get their funding from property taxes. So the schools are in really dire shape, public schools. I mean, really, the toilets are broken. I mean, they're in terrible, terrible, dire shape, and there's no money to fix affects them. So Walmart comes in, and basically these poor schools that are generally, you know, 90% black, and they come in and they say, hey, look, you know, why don't we, you know, team up? We can do what's called a public-private partnership, which is an oxymoron, because the private sector is only interested in profits. Therefore, it could never partner with the public. Does that make sense? Anyway, so they say, well, here's what we'll do. Why don't we come in and we'll offer courses, you know, and, you know, how to do bookkeeping, how to balance a checkbook, you know, home ec or whatever. And then we can provide internships for some of your students in our Walmart stores. Well, we won't be able to pay them, but at least they'll get hands-on experience, you know, in the retail market. Because after all, and this is the hidden message, after all, they're never going to work anyway. And if they're going to get a job, they're never going to go to medical school. They'll never be attorneys. You know, we're talking about a population surplus. Forget them. They'll be lucky if they ever get a job at Walmart. So, you know, why don't you allow us to keep? So what we can do is, we can, number one, we can contain them in a classroom. And that's what schools' functions today is. One of their functions is containment. What would those kids be if they weren't in class? Okay, so containment's a function of school. So Walmart says, yeah, we can contain them in there, and then we can all, and then they can come work to us for free. So they basically end up working, you know, as slaves for the corporation of Walmart. So that was the Walmart connection. The number of people got together by any means necessary, and Devon, a group of others, and they outed it and protested it and got parents together and put an end to it. But it'll rear its ugly head again, just like Kaplan is trying to partner with the community college here in California in offering classes that the community colleges can't offer. They're trying to get their nose under the tent. Once they get their nose under the tent, then it's just wiggling until the whole body's under there, man. So, yeah, that was the connection between them. In terms of what people can do, I'd like to call attention for people to a website, because here is something they can do. The website is www.OccupyStudentDebtCampaign.org. Let me repeat that. www.OccupyStudentDebtCampaign.org, and maybe you can link to it. It's basically been started by a teacher, a professor in New York, and it's basically calling for what's called a debt jubilee. And your readers can Google debt jubilee. Historically, they've been around for a long time. It's a petition. It's trying to get 1 million students to sign a petition that says they won't pay back their student loans. If we can get 1 million students to do that, then students will be brave enough to not do it. Because, see, nobody wants to be the first one to do it. So it's got to be a mass thing. Now, there are three petitions that can be signed. One, a student petition, can be signed by students that actually have debt, and, you know, then when the 999,999 person hits and you're the 1 million, then everybody has to stop paying their student loans. Okay, and that is a forced debt jubilee. All right, then there's another petition that can be signed by faculty, because faculty have got to start supporting their students, because faculty is getting paid from student debt. And it's very important. Professors at University of Maryland, their wages are student debt. That's how they're getting paid, because they get paid through tuition, and tuition is debt. So they need to come forward and stand with their students, and they have been very negligent in doing that. And there's a petition for them to sign, and then there's a petition for the average person to sign. Other than that, there's been Occupy Department of Education. You can Google that. It's time to take over closed schools. If Arne Duncan wants to close 5 schools in Detroit or in Chicago, then they need to be occupied. Occupy them and turn them into real schools. But, of course, this takes courage, and it takes a commitment to a lifelong struggle, and it takes commitment to facing a police state, and what a police state like Oakland will show you that they will do. But that is the only answer. There is no enlightened leader. No one's going to be born tomorrow that'll grow up to be Malcolm X. It doesn't work like that. It's us. We got to get up in the morning and look ourselves in the mirror. I know on Friday I'll be helping to occupy Wells Fargo up in my community here for running correctional prisons for ICE. Okay? Yeah. Anything that we can do, direct action is the answer right now. But that is a website that people can go to. They can learn more about the struggle against student debt, link to other people, both Facebook and through social networking. And I think that's another mode that we should use. Eventually we have to stop just paying. Just quit paying.
Yeah. Danny, what is the best email where folks can get a hold of you? Because I know there's going to be some folks that have already told me that they would like to make contact with you. So is there an email address that you feel comfortable giving out?
Yeah, certainly. People can... Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt. I just know you're pressed for time, and I am a bit too. People can feel free to email me at WeilUnion, WEILUNION. That's WeilUnion, WEILUNION, at AOL.com. The only caveat is to be sure to put in the subject matter, it's a result of your show or something. Otherwise, it'll get into spam, and, you know, I'm not going to open emails. I have no idea where the people are coming from, you know. So the subject matter's got to let me know that, you know, it's a result of your radio show or question regarding education or, you know, something, so that I'll open it. Otherwise, I won't open it.
Right. And real quick, what's the I know you're working on a big piece that's supposed to be unleashed on Truth Out. What is that piece about?
The Truth Out piece is basically about what I told you about, the poverty of pedagogy and the pedagogy of poverty, and it's basically about an 8,500 word treatise on a lot of the things that we've just been talking about, and probably more that are ancillary, and it's more heavily documented, and it's got evidence in it, and, you know, so that people can actually, if they're interested, read it, and I write in a vocabulary that's very different than a lot of educational writers. I use a lot of words that I borrow from crime novels, because these are criminal enterprises we're talking about, and they need to be outed as criminal enterprises. So, you know, a banker to me is a loan shark, and a for-profit college is a predatory subprime college. And so, you know, some readers like the way I write, some don't, but I write more like a noir, because that's kind of the time we're living in. This is a very dangerous time, my friend.
Right, yeah, and like Steve Biko, you write what you like, you know. So there's always critics out there, but you write what you like.
But I encourage people to. Thank you, and I encourage people to listen to your show and to read your great work, and to continue to listen to Black Agenda. And you guys be well, and thanks for having me on your show.
Thanks so much, Danny. Best.
All right, be well, Solomon. Bye bye.
You too. Bye. So that was Danny Weil, and. Wow, that was a heavy show. A lot of information, a lot of valuable information. You know, if it wasn't clear before, and I think, you know, just based on, you know, most of our listeners, it was clear before. But if it wasn't, it is clear now. And for those of us who was clear before, it should be even more. It should be crystal clear now. It almost should be 3D. Why this? This is another major issue, but it's once again, you know, connected to Wall Street. It's connected to big money. It's connected to the big money, the corporate, you know, ruling class in this country. And when Danny alluded, when he said 450 families control, you know, there are 450 families in this country, or 450 people in this country, that control more wealth than the bottom 155 million Americans. Think about that. 450 folks control more wealth than the bottom 150 million Americans. It is a crisis, and as Danny alluded, if you are watching reality shows, if you're watching game shows, if you're watching Springer, if you're watching, you know, any of these programs, and your life is revolved around catching up with the Kardashians or the Atlanta Housewives and Baseball Wives and all these other things that are out there. I mean, there's so many reality shows. Then you're being duped. At the same time, while you're doing that, there are these burglars that are breaking into your home. And they're stealing and robbing you blind. And if it's not of money, they're robbing you blind of humanity. They're robbing you blind of critical thinking. They're robbing you blind of common sense. Because the more you watch, the more you become dumbed down, the more you become disengaged with your own reality.
And that's why I think so many people watch reality shows to escape their own reality, you know. And as they do that, instead of dealing with their, you know, establishing strong connections and bonds with their next door neighbor, you know, you're looking at somebody else's life and family through the lens of television, you know. And we need to start building with our neighbors. We need to start each one teach one. We need to start sharing ideas with our neighbors. We need to, you know, even if it's difficult for your neighbors initially to even grasp, you know, this new information, you know, only you can make it in a language that is most palatable to them, because you're their neighbor. You're from their community, whatever the community is, you know. Make that connection to them. Make it so it's tangible, so it's palatable, you know, so they understand it. And these are the things that movements are made of. And so, yes, you know, you have the occupy this and occupy that and occupy this. Quite frankly, you can start building these movements, these broader movements, without going to and occupy this and occupy the other. Those are demonstrations. All right, the movement starts with the building and development of new organizations that may start off locally and then build out. These organizations can even merge to be political parties one day, you know, where we're having like tangible and feasible and viable, you know, alternative candidates and parties to the two corporate scavengers, you know, that are out there called the Democrats and the Republicans. There's not much difference between either of them. Really is not much difference between either of them. And, you know, Obama should have proved that to you, you know, to all of us, which I'm so thankful I didn't vote for him, you know. And no, I didn't vote for McCain, but I voted for Senator McKinney and the Green Party. But these, you know, broad movements and organizations start with these conversations that we have with people in our community. And those conversations breed ideas. And those ideas can be put and be brought into fruition as we start to build with from neighbor to neighbor, family to family. And now in our communities, now we start to see, wow, these weekly forums or the monthly town hall forums where people are coming together with these bold, bright ideas to reclaim their communities, and it can metastasize that way and linking one community to the next. It's so, so important. It's so, so important that we do that, especially folks of color, all right, because we have been occupied for a long time. So while these white liberals and you know, that are out there, and I'm not saying all of them, but, you know, it becomes such an issue when, you know, white activists when white students at Berkeley, UC Davis, and other places become pepper sprayed. Police brutality becomes now an issue, you know, but this is an issue that blacks and Latinos have been facing for generations. And we don't have the luxury of having pepper spray sprayed on us. We have bullets sprayed on us routinely. We have bullets rained upon us. Whether you're a 7-year-old black girl named Ayanna Stanley Jones in Detroit, Michigan, or if you are, you know, a young black man from Oakland, California named Oscar Grant, we have bullets rained upon us. And that is the form of police brutality, police terror that exists. Okay, and so black and brown communities have been occupied by the police for generations. That's the Occupy movement. That's the white settler state that I'm talking about. You know, these white Europeans came over to the U.S. Came over to Turtle Island, which is what the indigenous people called it. Coming over, and instead of building, you know, fellowship and kinship and so forth, and being grateful to the camaraderie and that was being offered to them by the, you know, the likes of Pequot and Narragansett and the Squamicut indigenous folks, they took their friendship and they spit in the face of it, and they massacred these people, and these Europeans then began to occupy Turtle Island, occupy Massachusetts, occupy Rhode Island, occupy Virginia, occupy here, occupy Puerto Rico, occupy Central America, occupy Argentina, occupy Brazil, you know, but we saw the Spaniards, the English, the Dutch, the British, I mean, you can go on and on, you know, occupying all over the place. And then kidnapping, you know, millions upon millions upon tens of millions of Africans and bringing them over here to this new land, only new to them, that they have now just occupied in complete totality and have reigned terror. This was the first Occupy movement, people. This was part of the first Occupy movement, and they occupied the continent of Africa, and they occupied the Pacific, and the I can just go on and on, and then they occupied Australia and Tasmania. They've occupied everywhere that they have gone and have brought a reign of terror to people of color the world over for a long, long time. And I'm not this radical, you know, this is not, you know, if you see this as some kind of radical pitch, this crazed, you know, black guy saying this, this is real world history. And if it's too hard for you, then to the hell of it with it. I don't give a damn. If you don't get it, if you don't get the rhetoric's too hard for you, this is the truth. And I could give a damn because tens of millions of people whose lives have been lost, you know, hundreds of years, throughout the last 400 or 500 years, all right, they need more of us to tell this story to more and more people. And some are going to reject it like the fools they are, like the inhumane animals they are, but others are going to raise ire to it, all right, and they're going to tell the story. And hopefully this will bring about, you know, some kind of movement as well as a change. But our communities, black and brown communities, have been occupied by the police for a long, long time, and they've brought terror as well. So this, and what we were talking about today is a byproduct of this orgy of capitalism and rugged, wretched institutional racism and white supremacy, you know, male domination wrapped all into this dirty, dirty ball. And they are fornicating in this, like, orgy of hell and death that they have continued to rain upon people of color the world over. And, you know, well-intentioned white folks need, you know, if you're well-intentioned, then you need to go into your communities, go into white communities and tell these stories and try to educate people in your communities. Try to educate young white folks before they're infested with, you know, with the dirtiness of American-styled racism and white supremacy. That is what your job should be, white activists. Go into your communities, occupy your communities, and educate them and hold weekly forums and town halls and have bullhorns and yell it, you know what I'm saying, so that all the, you know, the different white communities members that walk by, they have to hear these stories. Police brutality is killing black people every day in America. That's what you need to rain from the top of your lungs. This is what needs to be told. These are stories that need to be told. So, yes, I am in solidarity with these Occupy movements, as I think that they're very much needed. But I don't need to hear any more anybody else, you know, saying anything about why there are not more black folks, you know, that are going to these Occupy movements. I don't want to hear another damn, you know, criticism of black folks, more black folks not being there, all right? Because if the reasons are not apparent to you, then they may never be. They may never be, all right? There's a whole bunch of little intersectionalities that, you know, have fomented these reasons why more and more, you know, people of African ancestry are not at these Occupy movements. And I'm a person who has been at the Occupy movements. I most certainly have. But as an activist who has also been there, I've seen how the white media has purposely, you know, gone around black activists and not wanted to hear the perspectives and voices of black activists over there. You know, these are the racial dynamics, even within this movement. These are the racial dynamics and the racism that is even entrenched and that is firmly entrenched in so-called activism in America. You know, because many, you know, white activists are not ready to hear this kind of rhetoric. They're not they don't want to hear that America is a white settler state. They don't want to hear that America, and I'm not saying all, but a lot don't want to hear that America is infested with white supremacy and institutional racism. All right? So, yes, there's a problem with wretched, you know, runaway capitalism in this country, but there's also a fundamental problem with white supremacy and institutional racism that's rampant in this country that has created apartheid schooling, apartheid criminal justice, apartheid housing, apartheid economics, an apartheid nation it has created. And the only reason why more of us don't see this is because we have been blind and we have been sold a bag, a whole bag and batch of tainted goods, and it has occupied our minds. Our minds have been occupied where we cannot see what the hell is going on. And if you don't see what the hell is going on, how can you organize? How can you be that change that will go next door to your neighbor and build with your neighbor? That's where it starts. It doesn't necessarily have to start in this city or that city. Occupy, as I said, it can start right with you, going next door and having these conversations with the family next door and building with them. I'm most certain that there are, you know, folks who have the living tradition of the Malcolms and the Martins, the Fannie Hamers, and the Ida B. Wells deep within them. I know it. I know that they're out there. I know that they're out there. Just have to put one foot in front of the next and go next door, go down to a school, volunteer at a local juvenile detention center or the prison, and bring these ideas to those brothers and sisters who are incarcerated or that family next door. They're the ones that could use this spark of ideas. Because they, like you, can take it to the next level. And once we all start taking it to the next level, then we all can start radically shifting this paradigm and putting it back into the hands of the masses of people who are downtrodden, the people of color, the poor people, white, black, Latino, and so forth. But make no bones about it, all right? Do not simply think the issue in America is simply just capitalism. That's a huge issue. But there's a huge issue with sexism, institutional racism, white supremacy. We got to face it. So the game is a battlefield, and Dead Prez is going to take us out. Thank you for tuning in to another edition of Your World News. Look forward to our next show, and we have a blistering amount of shows that we're going to have within the next several days, so keep checking in, and like I said, we got some really good shows and really good guests coming up. We're going to be breaking down a number of things. We're going to be talking about everything from Congo to AFRICOM to a number of things. So once again, I'm Solomon, and for the entire Your World News staff, we thank you so much for tuning in, and here is Dead Prez. The game is a battlefield.
This is a mockery of your number one station that's brainwashing the nation. Playing the same old stereotypical musical as usual. With no balance or substance, cause you motherfuckers love it.
They scared of real hip-hop, like the threat of war. The game is a battlefield, but it's not a metaphor, it's real life. You get drafted by the A&Rs, you get sworn in and join in to play your part. Like a soldier, with no choice, you are what they say you are. They use your voice to wage a war. They send you across lands and over airwaves. The video program is like an air raid. Women and children in the line of fire. Today rappers is like mercenaries, soldiers for hire. Dog tags is gold chains, slugs is raps, killing brown and black. Like campaigns in Iraq, minefields in the wax. The
If it don't blow up, you get a bayonet in your back. Back on the block like a vet in the wheelchair, no health care. The same way the rap gang did the first pioneers of the battlefield. It's a takeover, not a makeover.
The word is the bullet. Peter Tosh had an AK for a guitar. I'm Che, but my pen is my cigar. Urban Gorilla Griot, other side of the peephole. It's a war outside. I say Fleo, Leo, Smeo, is it real? Audio terror, this ain't a drill. Now your helmet is a new era. Fashionista army apparel. Gun barrel, radio waves. Rapid return fire. Street call desire. It's the fall of the empire. Download your freedom using hi-fi, Wi-Fi, 5 verse 5. It's the media lie. Identify yourself, soldier. We ain't making classics no more. We getting over. Keep looking over your shoulder. Study the terrain. See, they watching the internet. They're studying your brain. And politics is war without guns. I said it before. Now they turn the battlefield into a dance floor. And it's hard to the core if you start to explore. It's hard to the core if you start to explore. Are really listening. This would have never been really played on the radio. It's a takeover.